Welcome to Healthbeat, a podcast from the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. I'm your host, Suniza Khan, a health policy and management graduate student, president of the Emory chapter of the Georgia Association of Healthcare Executives. Being in Atlanta, the public health capital of the world, our goal is to introduce you to many experienced individuals within this discourse community to discuss public health news, research, and career insight. Join us on this journey of meeting a diverse range of influential professionals within the healthcare field. If you have any questions or topics you wish to hear more about, message us on Instagram at EmoryGAHE for future Healthbeat episodes.
Hi, I'm Anisha Hussain, a health policy and management graduate student at Emory University and producer of Healthbeat. On today's episode, we will be discussing facets of mental health. Suniza will be joined by Danielle Fallon, the newly appointed dean of Rollins School of Public Health. Dean Fallon is an internationally renowned researcher who has led multiple CDC and NIH-funded projects regarding how environments, behaviors, genetic variation, and epigenetic variation contribute to risk for psychiatric disease.
Welcome to Healthbeat, Dean Fallon. Thank you for joining us here today. I wanted to start off by saying congratulations on your new position as Dean of Rollins School of Public Health. We wanted you to be our first guest, as I know many of us are eager to get to know you and learn from you as an exceptional leader and researcher in public health.
Thanks so much for the invitation. This is exciting to have this new podcast.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you here with us today. So let's just get right into this. Being a researcher in mental health epidemiology, could you expand on your journey as a public health official?
Sure. So in undergrad, I was very interested in math and biology and genetics, and I had no knowledge about public health or fields like epidemiology and biostatistics. And so when I found out about them, I thought, oh my gosh, this puts all of those things together. And then I went to pursue a master's degree myself in epi and biostats. And there started working for a genetics lab who had discovered the mutations for Alzheimer's disease. And so then learned about genetic epidemiology specifically. So even more of the math, biology, and genetics got put together, which was super exciting for me. So I began then a PhD in genetic epidemiology and got to work in Alzheimer's disease, which was special to me, like many of us have had, you know, a family member over time that's experienced dementia or Alzheimer's. And through that work, I was then exposed to other neuropsychiatric disorders, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and then ultimately ended up working in autism and what we now call autism spectrum disorder. So was really excited by the opportunities for learning about neuropsychiatric disease through the lens of genetics and then how genes and environment work together. I also got the privilege while I was at Johns Hopkins of being the chair of the Department of Mental Health. And that was super cool because then I developed a passion for public mental health broadly. So beyond just those particular disorders I mentioned, understanding all the ways in which public health intersects with mental health and how knowledge of mental health causes to interventions to policy can really shape the public's health broadly. I loved that work as chair for that reason, and also because I got to advocate for work beyond what I would ever get to do personally. I thought that was really fun. And that's one of the reasons that then I sought out additional leadership roles and how I ended up here. That what's really fun about being dean is, again, I get to help amplify and advocate for work across the full spectrum of public health research, education, and practice in ways that I would never get to do just on my own. And I find that wonderful.
That is amazing. I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned. So you spoke about how environmental factors can have a deep impact on mental health. Could you quickly talk about two major key concerns that you've seen throughout your research, which have a toll or effect on mental health?
Sure. So there are many. To pick two, I'll pick two kind of very different environmental factors, if you will. First, I think, is familiar to a lot of us, and that's lead. And so lead and other heavy metals, you know, we've known for, unfortunately, decades, if not longer, can have effects on neurodevelopment, and so can have multiple kinds of mental health outcomes and lasting lifelong effects, depending on when the exposure is. And unfortunately, although we've known that for a long time, we haven't solved it as a society. And we still have many parts of our own country and certainly across the world that have heavy lead exposure or other heavy metals. So that's one example I always highlight as, you know, it's not that we don't understand the risks. We really, as a public health community, need to think about the strategies for mitigation or amelioration of those risks. The other one I would say is psychosocial exposure. So trauma and particularly what we call ACEs or adverse childhood events. And those kinds of exposures over and over again have been shown to manifest in childhood, emerging adulthood, and lifelong mental and behavioral health consequences. And so it's really important to understand how these not only biological causal mechanisms like something like exposure to a toxicant or lead, but also psychological and sociological environments can manifest health problems, including mental health problems, which was your question. But I think it's important to say, you know, that's certainly not the only ones. And I would encourage us to think about environmental factors really broadly. So everything from these kinds of toxicant exposures through the, you know, health conditions that themselves become risk factors for further health conditions like obesity, and then other social conditions like structural racism, like increased use of screen time. All of those things are environmental factors where for public health, there's some evidence already, but where we as a field should continue to push and nudge and understand so that we can work on solutions.
Right. I completely agree with how it's important to highlight that there's not only a couple of factors, there's a whole interconnected web of just various factors that affect each other in different ways. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Hear, hear. That's the fun thing about public health, right? It's that we understand that it's not a linear story.
Definitely. So you touched a little bit about specifically lower socioeconomic status environments and how different socioeconomic statuses could have a bit, I mean, not a bit, quite a bit of an impact on individuals' mental health. So what do you see to be the most effective community-based intervention which can address mental health and specifically those environments and lower socioeconomic environments?
Yeah, so I think it's an important question. And I think there's no one right answer to this. It always begins with community, right? So if we're thinking about a community-based intervention, that concept doesn't exist if you haven't actually lived and breathed and had, you know, an integration with the community about what do they even see as the health challenge that needs to be solved, and then work together to either build evidence, you know, that would say which solutions work, or bring existing evidence that can be adapted to that community through to implementation. I have seen my colleagues in global mental health do this extremely well in low and middle income country settings, but it's certainly relevant in settings across the U.S. and the globe. To give you some examples, you know, for one community, a reasonable public health level intervention may be to increase peer support training and increase the funding and licensing around building a peer community, particularly in the absence of a workforce that's at a higher education level of training. But another solution in another group may be, you know, integration of mindfulness in school systems. I worked in Baltimore City where there was some really great evidence through community-based work that showed that if we could, you know, really engage in building coping skills in elementary and middle school students, that prepared them for coping through trauma exposures that unfortunately many of them were facing. And then lastly, an example of, you know, just general access. So access to pharmaceuticals that we know can be beneficial and to clinicians and other providers that we know can be beneficial. But for many folks, the intervention is really on the access level.
Definitely. Accessibility and also just getting those resources, having that access to resources is so vital to especially mental health. Besides like mental health, I think I really wanted to bring up something else that you touched on in the beginning today about autism. So I know you have particular experience working with autism research. What are factors in the realm of public health which you saw could be better fortified to bring awareness to this concern?
Yeah, so I think for many years in the autism world, there has been a focus on early identification because there's been some pretty good evidence that the earlier a baby or toddler is in being identified as having autism, the more you can develop strategies for that person that will help them throughout their development and into life. That's certainly still true. And, you know, policy and funding around building on that evidence base has been positive, has been really good. But what's emerging is the need to understand what happens next. So early identification and early intervention is great, but then there are lifelong challenges that people with autism face of different degrees and of different domains. And so now we are trying to understand and act upon, best employment placement training and opportunities, best educational supports and opportunities, other kinds of activities of daily living, if you will. And then on the other end, the upstream end, is still trying to understand actionable information around causes of autism and causes of the co-occurring conditions or experiences of people with autism. Again, so that we can provide information around interventions that would be beneficial for people in the autism community.
Right. And I think that is so important, especially just bringing awareness itself to this concern. And I read one of your research papers about screening for maternal fevers and infections during pregnancy. I recall reading about some inflammatory agent in your paper. I was just wanted to ask you to expand a bit more about this.
Sure, I'd love to. This is such an important area, and there's so many avenues, and I'll try to be quick. The evidence that you're talking about is that many groups have seen that experience of infection during pregnancy, and particularly that infection via fever during pregnancy, tends to be correlated with subsequent autism in that offspring, several years later. And the questions are, first, if that were true, could we pay closer attention to maternal immune activation during pregnancy as a matter of care? You know, and would that have an effect on the incidence and prevalence of ASD? The other challenge with that, though, is we haven't yet proven cause of that. So it could be that that's a co-occurring thing that happens in a pregnancy that already has a child that may develop ASD. The nuanced part to all this is a lot of talk about prenatal exposures and risk for later outcomes in children, including risk for autism, puts a lot of blame on moms and really creates additional anxiety for people when they're pregnant. And I'm concerned about that. And so in our research, we've always been sensitive to the idea that this is ongoing research, and if it informs better prenatal care that can help the health of your subsequent offspring, that's great, but it's never intended to be a source of additional guilt or blame for individual behaviors. I also like to articulate the concepts that you all are learning as public health students and public health professionals, that, you know, there's an individual story, which is critical, but there's also a population level set of evidence, which is what we build upon to, take next guidelines and actions. So I don't know if that helped to answer your question about that line of work.
No, that actually was very helpful and informative. I was just also wondering, what are some other additional questions to this specific research that you would want to know more about or look into further?
In the autism research?
Yeah, or even specific just to the maternal infections and fevers also.
So I think we need to understand whether it's the infection itself, or whether it's something about an immune response to infection, because those would have potentially different actions in terms of prevention. I also want to take a moment to say something about prevention and ASD. So many of our autistic colleagues and friends feel very, of my own, I should say, of my own autistic colleagues and friends, feel very nervous about the term prevention when thinking about autism, because they see that it could become potentially a message of eradication of people with autism, right? And that is absolutely not the case. And so we've had very frank conversations about what we mean by prevention and where in the course we mean prevention. And so I am very interested in understanding upstream things so that we could prevent the disabilities that are often associated with autism. And where we've come is that there's also lots of opportunity for secondary prevention, meaning, you know, amongst people who have autism, how can we prevent these particular co-occurring conditions that are problematic to their health and their well-being? But I want to take a moment, since I used the term prevention a couple of times, to clarify.
No, thank you so much for that. What are these secondary conditions that you just mentioned? Like, I just wanted to have a little background info for our listeners today.
Sure. So they're both physical and what we would think of as more mental health co-occurring conditions. So, for example, many people with autism also experience ADHD, so attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Through the life course, folks with ASD often experience anxiety and depression, maybe differently than folks who don't have a diagnosis of ASD. On the physical health side, there are often seizure disorders. And there are often GI or gastrointestinal disorders or disturbances that can be very concerning and actually the main source of loss of function for many folks. And I could keep going, but you can see just from that list that there are these other things that themselves can be actionable that can really change the quality of life for someone with autism.
Right. I had one last question regarding autism, as it's such an extensive topic. So having read about like the causes regarding autism, one correlation that I found to be the most fascinating personally was between the excessive metal accumulation in the nervous system and how certain foods, hygiene products, or common household items could be correlated to that. Has your research or personal reading exposed you to areas of understanding specific to our daily products that we use or foods?
Yeah, so the autism research on this is sort of mixed. So we actually have a grant on metals exposure during pregnancy and subsequent risk for autism. And I can tell you that there is some good evidence for metals exposure or metals amount in a pregnant mom or right at birth of a baby does appear to be correlated with subsequent autism diagnosis. Where it's less clear is later in life. So the correlation between having autism and having higher metal levels or accumulation, because just like you've learned in other areas of public health and particularly in epidemiology, the kind of temporal relationship there is confused. And there are a lot of preferences and eating changes and other things that happen throughout the life course, and particularly for someone with autism, that make that correlation hard to interpret. But if we're going back to the prenatal exposure period, I would say there's enough emerging evidence to say, let's keep exploring that and trying to understand that. And to your point about the sources of those kinds of metals exposure, absolutely. There are sources that come from food, from consumable products that we use, and certainly from air pollution, which is something we haven't talked about yet, where there's some evidence of autism. So I think there is an important story there from a public health perspective, but it's really about prospective exposure and later ASD onset rather than simultaneous metals accumulation and autism, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think what you brought up about pollution was very important. So I worked with the ACLU in New York in my undergrad, and I got a chance to learn about different exposures and how proximity to highways of just schools or houses could have an impact on brain development. And that was just so interesting to learn how just like it's something that is right in front of you, but you don't often think about like this is some environmental concern that could potentially be harming children or like exacerbating more symptoms.
Absolutely.
Of individuals.
Such an important point. And again, much like the lead story I mentioned earlier, it's not that we aren't aware that air pollution has, you know, harmful health consequences. And we have, as a society, changed policies in the right direction, but we haven't fully solved the problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. So now that we have a little bit more time left, I just had a quick question. It's a bit more personal, away from like what we just spoke about today. So as you're stepping into this influential role as dean of RSPH, what is one grounding technique or affirmation that has helped you deal with your day-to-day stress?
Oh, so good question. I'm not sure I can give you exactly the one affirmation, but if you mean for how do I manage my own mental health? I think for all of us, you know, we have our ups and downs, but for me, running in the morning is really helpful. And then honestly, a really short, like 5-10 minutes at most mindfulness exercise of some kind is just really useful to like, clear everything before starting again. If you mean more in terms of like mantras and things, for me, it's always focusing on what's exciting and what am I grateful for? And even if I'm having the most terrible day, I can always come up with something that's exciting and something that I'm grateful for. And those may sound silly, but they matter.
I love that. No, they definitely matter. I'm just curious for like my own knowledge. So how long have you been practicing this?
Yeah.
Like these practices of running and mantras and mindfulness
at techniques. Least a decade. I'm trying to think. My kids are 11 and 13.
Oh, wow.
And I would say that I can remember doing this even when they were pregnant. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was enlightened enough to even try this kind of self-care when I was in my 20s, I have to tell you.
I'm actually starting to get into this. So I was just hoping for that advice. But I think considering how big of a role that you have and how successful you are, I think that's definitely the way to go. But yeah, I guess that sums it up for today. Those are all our questions for today. Thank you so much, Dean Fallon, for taking some time out of your day to be with us. And it was truly a pleasure.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for the invitation. I look forward to hearing the podcasts to come.